Good evening. I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here on Global Patriot Radio. We can be found on blogtalkradio.com. Mondays, Vito Esposito, the Vito Esposito Show featuring Vito and Big Al, Mama Mia No Sharia, that goes at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Wednesdays, it's me, Hank Jones, with Hank Jones Poly Sports, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. I am not doing hankerings for the next at least month, probably, because I've got slamming with paddles right now, so I won't be doing Thursday hankerings. May figure a different day. Just depends. Saturday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time, Minister Usama Dakduk and the beautiful Christy revealing the truth about Islam. It's cold here in Orlando. A little better than it's been, but I've been waking up in the 40s, which I know, some of you, it's nothing, but for us, it could get brutal. I had some paddles last week where I was waking up and getting out there at 40 degrees, man. It's cool, though. I like it. So, hey, the mini Aussie has been fed, twixt and between the Space Force Observation Outpost and Acoustic Hank Land. He's hanging out in the middle, sort of. So today's first Internet Laffy from the Babylon Bee. Experts attribute falling public school literacy to not enough drag queen story hours. Oh, my God. Oh. So let's get to last week's losses that I deem significant. Last Wednesday, back on the 27th of December, still in 2023, Herb Kohl, former U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, co-founder of Kohl's Department Stores, and he owned the Milwaukee Bucks from 1985 to 2014. He was 88. Thursday, the 28th, we lost guitarist Tommy Talton. Played with Greg Allman, notably on his debut solo album, Laid Back. That was a great album by Greg Allman. Midnight Rider, Queen of Hearts. Tommy Talton was 74. Friday, we lost Maurice Hines, dancer, singer, actor. He is the brother of the late Gregory Hines. Maurice was 80. Killer Khan, former pro wrestler, wrestled in Stampede up in Calgary, wrestled for the WWF before it became WWE, wrestled in the Mid-South. He was 76. Jazz pianist Les McCann passed away last Friday, age 88. And then we also lost, this is kind of sad because I grew up in the Chicago area, grew up watching this guy, DePaul Blue Demons former head basketball coach Joey Meyer. He was the son of DePaul legendary coach Ray Meyer. And Joey took over, stayed for a few years, gosh, probably about 10 or 11 years, something like that. He was just 74. Saturday, we lost British actor Tom Wilkinson from the Full Monty, Michael Clayton. He was 75. Sunday, the last day of the year, we lost American comedian actor Shecky Green at the age of 97 and former NASCAR racer, Cup champ, actually, a couple times, Cale Yarborough was 84. Monday, the first day of the year, we lost former NFLer turned mathematician Frank Ryan. He was 87. And then yesterday, we lost former Cuban Olympic sprinter Osvaldo Lara, age 68. He was in the 1980 Olympics in Moscow, made the final of the 100-200, did not win. And then in 1984, remember the Soviets turned around and boycotted the LA Olympics in 1984, so they had their friendship games, sort of like we had our freedom games in 1980. Osvaldo Lara won the freedom game, or the friendship games, 100 meters at that fake Olympics. Please remember to pray for Felicia Goodson and her family going through cancer treatments. She might be in between, but great lady. Please pray for her and her family. Don't forget my friends, Alliance Communications, Central Florida's premier 24-hour call center answering and messaging services for your medical clinic, hospital clinic, service company, property management. They even do government contracting. If you're a remote worker, they work with remotes frequently. It's a great idea. So if you're looking for their services, you're looking for some remote work, or if you're one of those companies that never returned to your office after COVID, give them a call, 800-555-3738. Look them up on the web, alliancecommunications.com. So to give you an idea of how bad left-wing media has gotten in Orlando, I bring you this from the Orlando Weekly. It's going to sound stupid. I signed up for their emails because I want to be able to vote in their contests. Company I work for, paddle touring company, they frequently get put up for best tours, best paddleboard company, best kayak tours, whatever. So I want to be able to vote. So this is what they published last week. 12 Waves Giving, a dozen organizations doing essential work in Orlando worth your support. I think this is alphabetical. I hope so. Doesn't matter. Here's their first one. CARE, Florida, Council of American Islamic Relations. It says, it's a national organization with state-based chapters across the country, including here in Florida. Their Florida team is focused on defending the civil rights of Muslims in Florida, as well as advancing justice and equity for all. That's crap, folks. Then it goes on to say, dehumanization is a dangerous tactic leveraged by authoritarian regimes to turn citizens against each other versus holding governments accountable and to justify acts of mass violence against targeted communities. Here's where it goes on. After more than 1,000 Israelis were murdered by the terrorist group Hamas, and as tens of thousands of innocent civilians in Gaza are murdered by the Israeli military, we are seeing deeply rooted hate manifest into targeted action against Muslims in Florida and across the country. CARE Florida is tackling their threats head on. That is such bullshit. They lie. They lie. They say, Islamophobia, like all prejudices, is deeply rooted in white supremacy. Next one, Central Florida Jobs with Justice. Local nonprofit fights hard for workers' rights in the Central Florida area. Their cornerstone tenets of their mission are that workers deserve collective bargaining, job security, and a dignified standard of living. Why? What they are, like most quasi-unions, are extortionists. That's all they are. His next one, Central Florida Trans Emergency Care Fund, launched this year by the LGBT Plus Center in Orlando and the Contigo Fund, in response to state legislation restricting gender-affirming care. No, it's minor. It's protection of minors. Contigo Fund, yeah, organized in the aftermath of the Pulse nightclub massacre, providing financial resources to LGBTQ plus people of color in Central Florida, particularly Latinx committees. The Desiree Foundation, anti-poverty initiative, works with historically disenfranchised communities. That's almost legit. Equal ground. Defending the freedom to vote and advancing justice locally. What do you mean? That's not what you're defending. You're defending the right to manipulate elections is what you're defending. Floridians Protective Freedom. A statewide campaign that works to defend abortion access and support bodily autonomy. Really? Okay. This is a good one. The Holocaust Memorial Resource and Education Center of Central Florida. It is a good organization. My private foundation that I've worked with has actually supported them. The Hope Community Center, that's up northwest in Apopka. They work with migrant workers, youth, etc. And that is a good group. It's a great group. Peer Support Space, Navigating Mental Illness, especially when America's public mental health system is largely broken. Agree. Stand with abortion now. Really? That's what the people should give to? Zebra Youth. That says, it's been a year rife with anti-LGBTQ plus legislation. Nothing could be further from the truth. They say, don't say gay laws. It says, Orlando's Zebra Youth has found that 59% of queer students feel unsafe in schools. And shouldn't it be 89% of them are catered to? So yeah, I had to join this email list to be able to vote in their stuff. But this is the kind of stuff they say we should be giving to. Isn't that lovely? As if that isn't enough, they did this story. I kid you not, they did this story. This story is, well, if it would ever open, and it's garbage. We deserve better. Wells Fargo bankers join national unionization drive. Workers in the banking industry, the labor union affiliated with the Communication Workers of America, Wells Fargo Workers United. Now, first of all, Wells Fargo, over the recent last 10, 12 years, has been absolutely hammered for deceptive practices like churning accounts, opening accounts. In other words, let's pretend you have a big savings account. They would be taking that, creating another account that they would say was a high earning savings account, and just opening accounts or churning trades. These people want to unionize? Yeah, unions. If unions start making a comeback, and I'm not saying that all unions are bad, but if unions start making a comeback, we may as well just admit that Dopey Joe was created by the mob in Scranton, Pennsylvania, by the Northeastern Pennsylvania family, otherwise known as the Pittstown family. Russell Bufalino, Joe Barbara. Speaking of Joe, Joseph Gibson's in the chat room for those of you listening that would like to get in there. Coming in, log in, head in the chat. Joseph Gibson is in here, as well as Boyd the Alaskan. Joseph Gibson, as I've said before, is for State House, District 65 in North Carolina. He also has a show here on Blog Talk Radio called Restoring Our Republic. It's normally Tuesday nights, but I think he does other shows depending on need or subject matter, et cetera. My big sister's listening on the phones. That number, by the way, 319-527-6706. Yeah, so literally, Wells Fargo says, workers say, we deserve better. Says, we are igniting a fire and showing our colleagues across the industry that not only is change possible, it's within reach. Change for what? Says, it's part of an organizing campaign that bankers say has been years in the making in an industry that's historically been hostile to unions. Well, yes. Why? What has happened historically over the years with unions? I'll tell you what. Embezzlement. Guess who loses when union leaders embezzle? The people that put the money in, the workers. So an Albuquerque, New Mexico branch voted in favor of unionizing, making Wells Fargo the first major U.S. bank with a unionized workforce at one of their branches. Corrine Jefferson, a banker for Wells Fargo at the Daytona Beach branch, told Orlando Weekly, we want better, we deserve better. There's all kinds of things that workers need, not just with Wells Fargo, across the U.S. that they're not getting. She's originally from the more labor-friendly state of New Jersey. By the way, the five families of New York, what used to be called the DiCavalcante family, otherwise known as the New Jersey family. You know, one of the things that smacked them down was when the government went after unions and mob control of the unions, construction workers, Teamsters, hotel and restaurant employees. Prior to her work for Wells Fargo, she worked in the casinos in Atlantic City, which was a union-represented job. Yeah, that's what we need in the casinos, a union. And, you know, they say, we want everybody to, one by one, we can get this done. We want everybody. Yeah, you know why? And what I said before about care, extortionists, race baiters that are extortionists, that's what they want. I'll tell you what, this is a definite way that we can speak out. This is definitely a way you can speak out without boycotting. Remember, it's your money that's sitting in these places. So it says, over the years, they've acknowledged this. This one lady, she's organizing a committee for better banks, a coalition of bankers and labor organizations. After scandal rocked the Wells Fargo Bank. Over the years, they've come under fire for opening up millions of fake accounts, maintaining allegedly discriminatory mortgage practices, scheduling fake job interviews in an effort to increase diversity numbers, and more recently violating the workers' federally protected right to organize and form a union. So here's how their twist. The bank, which has already enlisted the help of lawyers from the notoriously anti-union Littler Mendelson law firm. Folks, this is your money that's sitting in these places. Now, here's the thing. They sit there and complain that they're paid hourly. They scramble to juggle their responsibilities, blah, blah, blah. They say it creates longer wait time for clients. Here's what they're looking for. They're looking for extortion money. It's just like the movements you're hearing about in sports, in college sports, to make all athletes get a minimum payment. Why? Because they deserve it. Well, they don't. Look, I get that there are these huge contracts, TV contracts for the conferences, and the players are creating that need and all that stuff. Doesn't mean they're entitled to every bit of it. But remember, this is your money that sits in these banks. Banks are going to be required to contribute to these unions in some way, shape, or form. This is another thing this lady says. Our health insurance is so high that I have coworkers that are not able to go to the doctor because they can't afford their deductibles. I have coworkers that have lived out of their car because their pay is not keeping up with inflation. Guess what? They already weren't responsible with their money, because anybody who's blaming inflation for having to move into their car is full of crap. Look, I've never been quote-unquote rich in my life. Done fine. I mean, I'm not poor, destitute, nothing like that, but I've never been wealthy. What would be considered wealthy. And over the years, there have been times I've been stupid with credit cards or whatever, but I don't anymore. But my wife and I aren't frivolous with our money. We don't buy what we can't afford. We don't spend what we don't have. But somebody that's got a full-time job who says they have to live in their car because of inflation, was already living that close to the bone. There's no way, and I don't care if it means two income families or splitting rent or whatever. Say, working families and adults on a fixed income are in a precarious position in Florida. But also, Florida's insurance market is in peril. You know why? Because people like me who aren't stupid enough to build a million-dollar house on a beach are paying for those are stupid enough to build million-dollar houses on a beach. As of last year, Florida had the third highest homeless population in the United States. You want to know what else? This will come as a shock. The fourth highest population overall. So it stands to reason, doesn't it? Four or five highest population states would also have the four or five highest amount of homeless. Here's another thing Ms. Jefferson says. They absolutely can take care of the employee, and they're not. Unbelievably, these people balk at the fact that management of a bank or any company would hire consultants about unionization issues. She says they're handing out flyers, some of these consultants. They're not really giving true information, she said. It's kind of just trying to discourage the employees to kind of back down. I'll never forget something my father told me. He actually sold one time a company, one of his old offices in the Chicago area, and that company lost out to the union. I'd never had any kind of issues like that when I ran the company after my father died. You know why? I don't treat my employees like shit. But you know what else? I let them know they're human. I mean, this is unbelievable. This started because somebody in a union pushed for it. It wasn't somebody at Wells Fargo saying, you know, my guess, oh no, I shouldn't say that. It doesn't matter. A union went in there somehow and pushed for it. Because these things don't just pop up out of the blue. So that's another thing they printed. And the Orlando Weekly, or otherwise known as the Orlando Weekling, reported on this. The One Pulse Foundation. What was the Orlando nightclub? Remember the Pulse nightclub? City of Orlando is going to preserve the Pulse nightclub legacy as the One Pulse Foundation dissolves. The nonprofit One Pulse Foundation sent its final email Monday evening, this was last week, to inform stakeholders that the City of Orlando, not the foundation, this is actually right the week before Christmas, will lead efforts to establish a memorial honoring Pulse shooting survivors and victims of the former gay nightclub's property. City will establish a new memorial fund that individuals, businesses, and community organizations can donate to in support of the Pulse Memorial Project, which One Pulse was formed to do 7 years ago. With little progress made and following accusations of profiteering, One Pulse announced plans to dissolve the nonprofit in November. Board of directors voted to dissolve it. Board Mayor Dyer believes the best approach to creating a memorial at the Pulse site is for the City of Orlando to lead the process. Of course he believes that. Let me tell you something. As long as he gets his name in the papers, on the TV, on the radio, on the internet, he's all for it. There are few better at spending other people's money than this guy. Someday I will tell the story of what a disingenuous jackwagon this guy is. City leaders unanimously approved a $2 million purchase of the Pulse nightclub in October after former property owners declined to donate their property. It's unbelievable. Permanent memorial on the existing Pulse nightclub site. $2 million for a memorial on a piece of property that, frankly, it's probably less than a quarter acre. And it's not right downtown. It's south of downtown. It is, I mean, this is what we've come to. It's literally, well, they're being sued, for one, by survivors. So the city is trying to cover up code violations the city was aware of prior to 2016. Unpermitted 8-foot-tall fence that survivors say hindered escape. City told the Orlando Weekling the Pulse facility was safe. It met occupancy, fire, and related requirements. Although the city's fire safety department noted exit door or hardware inoperable. It really is. I mean, that's the way media has gotten, even in my community. Sentinel's always been somewhat liberal. But I consider it to be to have the ability to be objective. Now, this one's good. It comes from the Patriot Journal newsletter. After Christian magazine makes a shock Jesus statement, Bible experts quickly set the record straight. So a recent news media interpretation about the birth and origin of Jesus set off a social media firestorm during Christmas. So Christianity Today published this, referenced the opinion of the source as a more representative interpretation of Jesus' birth and life. The ideas, well, here's what they said. They said Jesus was born in Asia. He was Asian. East Asia, Southeast Asia. The article also said that, by representing Jesus as Japanese, Indonesian, or Indian, they convey a sense of God's immanence, his with-usness for their own communities. So a Christian blogger said, blasphemy, Jesus was a Jew. It is necessary for our salvation that he is a son of David from the tribe of Judah and born in Bethlehem. Stop this nonsense. He isn't European, Asian, Palestinian, or black. He's a Jew, the king of the Jews, and therefore the savior of the world. One guy, Father Edward Beck, on CNN said Jesus was a Palestinian Jew and came from an occupied country. One guy said, a Palestinian Jew born into a time when his country was occupied, right? Well, wrong. Palestine was not even a creation of the Roman Empire. Didn't exist at the time of Christ's birth. So one person said, Father Beck has to stop watching Al Jazeera and start reading the New Testament. That's where our media is going with this, folks. They're just starting to, at this point, they just say whatever they want. They don't care. Patriot Action Journal, not Patriot Journal News, but newsletter, but Patriot Action Journal, has this story about a new form of the Underground Railroad. Woke activists announce shock Underground Railroad. You won't believe who they're smuggling. The term Underground Railroad goes back to the Civil War era. New group called the STY, STYE Project, has announced their own kind of underground railroad. However, this project is not about free slaves. Instead, they are trying to undermine states that are protecting underage children. Pain for Southern Equality has created a special project to help gender-confused minors get sex change operations if they live in a state that has banned the practice. Project provides, quote, rapid response support directly to the families of youth who are impacted by anti-transgender healthcare bans in the South. Through the organization and in close partnership with state and local organizations, we are providing grants, patient navigation support, and accurate information to impacted families. As one person said on X, formerly known as Twitter, imagine creating an underground railroad to smuggle children across state lines so that you may sterilize them. Seriously, folks, you can't make this stuff up. Steve Day said it long ago, seemingly long ago. It's not the drag shows that you should be questioning. It's their quest to have five-year-olds at these drag shows that you should be questioning. Unbelievable. And here's a really good piece from the American Briefing website. This one, I think I might read the actual read it for you, because it's a good question. And it says, question, the story is doxing ever okay? The ethical propriety of identifying by name students and faculty who assigned anti-Semitic statements or engaged in anti-Semitic actions is currently being debated. Opponents of disclosure call it doxing, as if that term ends the debate. But doxing is a meaninglessly broad concept that must be deconstructed in order to give it any reasonable interpretation. Condemnation was first directed at people who published the home addresses and private telephone numbers of individuals whose politics they disagreed with, occasionally including providing the names of children and locations of their schools. Some doxing involved disclosing the sexual preferences and other private information thought to be embarrassing. But until the recent Israel-Hamas war, the accusation of doxing has not been directed at those who have merely identified individuals who participated in anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, or other bigoted activities. The debate thus far has been over whether any kind of doxing is ever permissible. You know why? Because it's being turned against those who started the doxing. Indeed, efforts have been made to get universities to ban all doxing, and some schools have created special counseling offices to deal with the consequences of doxing to students. As a general matter, most doxing is protected by the First Amendment. It would be unconstitutional for government-supported institutions to prevent the publication by some students or the media of properly obtained information about other students. The Constitution cuts both ways on this issue. It protects the protests while also protecting disclosure of the protesters' identification by the doxers. Beyond the constitutional issues are concerns about the ethical propriety of various kinds of doxing. This has taken on added urgency in the age of the Internet, as the names of doxed individuals are instantaneously circulated around the world, often generating insulting and sometimes threatening responses. Little attention has been paid to the factors that might distinguish acceptable. Here are some such factors. Does the nature of what the doxers disclose go beyond mere identification of the individuals and the organizations to which they belong? There is a considerable difference between disclosing the mere identity of protesters and providing private information, such as addresses, phone numbers, names of children, and sexual orientation. Though most such disclosures may be protected by the law, some deserve moral opprobrium. A related distinction is between doxing that poses a realistic threat of violence and that endangers career prospects, such as jobs, university admission, or a political future. The case for not disclosing the former is more compelling than the case for not disclosing the latter. A third factor might be the role of government in either compelling or prohibiting disclosure. During the Civil Rights Movement, compelled disclosure of the membership lists of organizations such as the NAACP. Now there are efforts to get the government to prohibit disclosure of the names of protesters. Others argue that the government should remain neutral, neither compelling nor prohibiting disclosure. Interesting, because it says the ethical propriety of doxing should not be a left-right issue. The same rule should apply to disclosing the names of right-wing protesters, such as those who marched in Charlotte or lawfully protested in front of the Capitol on January 6th, call for Palestine to be, quote, free from the river to the sea. Yet some who would disclose the identity of the former seek to prevent disclosure of the latter. You know where this is going, right? In other words, liberals think it's okay to dox when it's conservatives that they are doxing. Okay, so it's a difficult question whether disclosure should depend on nonviolent but unduly harsh consequences to the person disclosed. In a recent case, MIT refused to impose public discipline, which would have required disclosure, on students who violated the rules of the university, but who reasonably feared that losing student visas would result in deportation. Some argue that the consequences should not be the concern of those deciding whether to disclose, since who might be deported is the proper business of other institutions, such as the State Department. Applying these factors to the current situation, I believe it is generally appropriate to disclose the names of individuals who are active members of organizations that, on October 8th, before Israeli troops entered Gaza, praised Hamas or blamed Israel for the murders, beheadings, rapes, and kidnapping of civilians. It is also proper to disclose the names of student and faculty who are currently calling for the end of Israel. The author says, I plan to continue to provide the names and organizational affiliations of such anti-Semites and bigots, just as I would disclose the names of members of the Ku Klux Klan or the Nazi Party who praised lynchings or harassed gays. Author, by the way, is M. Lance. Doesn't give a whole name. Interesting. So, he's right, of course. You know, public disclosure. I mean, somebody, there's a difference between revealing the names of all, is there a difference between revealing the names of all NRA members versus all Greenpeace members? Well, leftists would say not revealing Greenpeace members is correct, while revealing NRA members is good. I'm sorry, revealing Greenpeace members is wrong. Revealing NRA members is good. When Greenpeace, say, blows up a whaler ship, that's cool. Kyle Rittenhouse defending himself, not cool. Now, one thing he says, if the result of his, of his revelations of such disclosure is that some law firms or other businesses refuse to hire such bigots, so be it. Individuals, whether students or faculty, should be held accountable for their advocacy. Pursuant to the marketplace of ideas, there should always be a presumption in favor of full disclosure of all relevant information, including names. This presumption can be overcome by a showing that individuals reasonably fear violence if identified. There is little evidence that anti-Israel students and faculty whose names have been disclosed have been subject to physical threats. People should be safe from violence, but not from being held accountable for their ideas. Talks about some pro-Palestinian protesters have themselves engaged in violence, threats, harassment, and the denial of free speech. While doing so, they often wear masks or other identity-hiding face coverings. I'm not suggesting that universities should be compelled to identify them, but rather that it is ethical for decent people to try to learn their identities by legitimate means and to disclose them. Such disclosure should apply to pro-Israel advocates as well. Their names and organizational affiliations, and they should bear any legitimate consequences of their advocacy. There is little evidence that such advocates are denied jobs in the United States, though some may fear discrimination by universities or physical violence by anti-Israel extremists. Everyone should be protected from physical violence, threats, or harassment, but not from recrimination for their views. The open marketplace of ideas requires no less. Okay, so it was actually done, written by Alan Dershowitz last week. M. Lance just reprinted it, I guess. It is a good question, this doxing that takes place. when you simply reveal someone's name in order, hopefully, to bring shame, that's wrong, no doubt. Welcome, Boye, Snowman James, both into the chat room. I don't know this, but respond appropriately, Snowman James. I think Snowman James might also be Duck Northwest Media, but I could be wrong. It begs some questions. You know, jurors, as an example, we usually find out who jurors are after high-profile trials. Jurors who are protected and sequestered during a trial often end up benefiting later on. Now, of course, that means publicly known after the fact. But they are also held accountable. I mean, they are often asked for their vote. I don't know if they have to reveal it. I mean, I guess they would. In most cases, it would be a foregone conclusion. But jurors should be protected during the trial, not just for their protection, but for the protection of a defendant, especially in a criminal trial. I mean, people like John Gotti used to buy jurors or threaten jurors. So naturally, jurors need to be protected. Now, when they say things like, should Sammy Gravano be able to make money after he's, you know, killed people, et cetera, been convicted or whatever, that's sort of a different question, I guess. Cases, I believe, they've been prohibited from, or they are subject to civil suits. As an example, Sandy Gravano participated in, I believe, 19 murders. So if he makes money off that stuff, off of books or whatever, there's no reason that somebody shouldn't be able to file a civil suit against him. I get that. But doxing's a different issue, in a way. Doxing is really more about people who think they can hide behind, say, an internet, you know, tough guy name or whatever. I mean, I don't use my real name. It's not because I'm worried about my own safety. It's Vito and Al in the past have been, I dare say threatened, but basically threatened. Or there's been attempted intimidation. So telling everyone who I am could theoretically tie me to them. People could know who they are. So that's why I don't. I mean, you know, if those of you that know the history of how I came up with the name Hank Jones, I mean, that's, you know, that's a different story. But, you know, really, it's a good question because the people that have been famous for doxing have been the left. The left has been diligent, vigilant in doxing stuff. Now, some of their people are getting doxed. People who have signed on to some of these Ivy League, let's get rid of Israel or let's protect Hamas or ceasefire or whatever. Some of them are saying, we can't get jobs. Employers aren't looking at us now. I've lost job interviews. Well, why shouldn't you? I mean, what I don't understand about this, I'm just going to sound like I'm anti-Semitic, not at all. But how many Wall Street firms have Jewish employees, including those in management? How many hospitals? How many companies in general have, of course, probably almost all of them, other than halal meat companies, which, you know, but I mean, probably almost every, I mean, of course. So if I'm a hiring manager and I'm Jewish and I see people that are marching for Hamas or fake Palestine, or saying end Israel, or calling Israel an illegal regime, or saying Israel is murdering people during what is actually a war. Yeah, I don't have to hire that person. They'll say, no, it's not. Person's not a good fit at our company. Somebody who's marching with the KKK, I got news for you. That person's not getting hired by me. Simply isn't going to be. Now, somebody who says, I don't agree with the Second Amendment, okay, that's whatever. That person's still got a shot. But if they say all guns should be taken away, good luck getting a job in my where I'm the hiring manager. Then again, I wouldn't hire a Nebraska fan either. So, I mean, that's kind of – but still, the question remains. It's not so much is doxing ever okay. The question is who determines what it is and what it isn't? Because the double standard is in full effect right now. There are people who say, oh, my name was given, I can't get a job. Well, you know, before you go marching against Israel or in support of Hamas, consider the consequences. I mean, who wouldn't do – anybody who's smart, anybody who's rational, a rational thinker already knows that. So going to take a quick break, and then I'll come back with a little end of 2023 memorial that I read from a guy on my favorite guitarist, Jeff Beck. And then I'll get to my college. We'll be back in a couple. This is the last time that I play it for a long, long time. So enjoy this tune. We'll be back. And we are back. You're not going to have to hear that one for a while. But people always say, why do you play it now? Christmas isn't over. As Christmas Day has come and gone, the Christmas season is not over. Those who are up on their church calendar would understand that. Anyway, so Boyd made a good point, the Alaskan in the chat room. He says, if you can't handle the blowback from your actions, then you must not feel you support your idea very strongly. Also says, just like conservatives who got fired from their jobs, people that didn't do the vaccine as an example, or whatever. Boy, he says we have April 1st tunes. So I'll probably play Bicycle Built for Two and Let Me Call You Sweetheart on, oh my gosh, yeah, it's heard. So 28th day. Yeah, Valentine's Day is going to be on a Wednesday. Oh God, Mr. Hank's going to love that. But yeah, I mean, conservatives lost their jobs, or people against the vaccine lost their jobs. Can't handle the blowback if you're not willing to, I mean, if you truly support your idea and have convictions, then you should simply say, okay, I get it. People don't want to hire me. That's the breaks. That's how they should view it. They should understand it, but of course they don't, because they're entitled. Okay, real quick, I'm going to read this, and then we're going to get to college football. It's a great piece memorializing Jeff Beck. Remember, it's been almost a year since he passed away. My favorite guitarist of all time is the best. There's so many. That's so subjective. But he died last January at the age of 78. He was a pioneer of psychedelic rock, jazz, fusion, and even trance blues. Born in 1944 on Hawkeye Mike's same birthday, June 24th, by the way, and grew up in Surrey, which is part of London. He first heard electric guitar when he was 6 years old. Les Paul on the radio playing How High the Moon. Fascinated with the instrument, by age 13, he had built two or three of his own guitars. While in art school, he played in a succession of London bands until Jimmy Page, later of Led Zeppelin, recommended him as a replacement for Eric Clapton in the Yardbirds, where he would spend almost 2 years. Innovative from the beginning, he was constantly pushing the limits of technology. His abuse of the commercial fuzz box for the Yardbirds' Heartful of Soul, has been cited as perhaps the first significant use of the effect that would become standard in rock music. During the time with the Yardbirds, he worked on a side project that produced this instrumental called Beck's Bolero, along with Jimmy Page, John Paul Jones, and an incognito Keith Moon. After leaving the Yardbirds, he went on to release the album Truth with vocalist Rod Stewart. As it says, blues had never sounded so heavy. In 1975, he went instrumental, released Blow by Blow, monumental album, classic fusion album, produced by George Martin, no less. That album went to number 4 on the Billboard charts, an instrumental. Think about it. I mean, you do have instrumental hits, but an album? Going to number 4 instrumental album. Next year he did Wired with Jan Hammer. Says he basically, with those two albums, redefined what the electric guitar was capable of. Although he could play blindingly fast, he was more likely to use clever phrasing and tone manipulation to achieve his unique sound. By the way, Hendrix, same way. It's not unique to those guys either. But, you know, it's often, as they say, sometimes the best notes are the ones you don't play, all that. He was constantly fiddling with technology and often on the leading edge of what was possible with electric guitar and music productions. He was perhaps at his best when working with an equally intense counterpart, whether it be a singer like Rod Stewart or Joss Stone or an instrumentalist like Jan Hammer. He played with an ever-rotating cast of musicians, preferring to go it on his own without the security and identity of being in any one band. He may have paid an economic price for not tying himself to a chart-topping lead singer, but he was able to remain true to his musical vision and free to constantly reinvent himself. One of the most expressive guitarists of all time, Jeff Beck told NPR in 2010 that he was trying with his guitar to be a singer, which he most definitely was. By the time he passed away, he had been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame twice, once with the Yardbirds and once as a solo artist. He won 8 Grammy Awards and is listed at number 5 on Rolling Stone's list of 100 Greatest Guitarists. His passing was mourned throughout the music world for a man considered to be one of the best guitarists of his generation. Very well said. Even now, a year later, I mean, it's hard to believe. Very hard to believe that he's gone. So, okay, I said I was going to talk about it. Said we were going to get to it. But let's, here's an internet laugh, another internet laughy. It's great. The picture that goes with it is hilarious. Nations, white liberals, which wish each other a happy Kwanzaa. I know that's lost on any of you liberal listeners, but it's good. Another good one. Here's another good one. Ron Paul asks Santa Claus to end the Fed for the 47th straight year. Yeah, I know. I'm not against ending the Fed per se, but it is true. Ron Paul kind of. So there were some definitely some good games, good moments during the bowl season. And then there was the sadness of the Orange Bowl, where FSU, Florida State, showed up without 29 of their players, whether it was injury, opting out for the draft, entering the transfer portal, probably the biggest kick in the teeth for them. Their second string QB, Tate Rodemaker, who became the starter after Jordan Travis got injured, he decided to enter the transfer portal less than a week or a week before the game. I'm sorry, that is beyond crappy. It's beyond ridiculous. It's the epitome of selfishness. I mean, I get it in one sense. It appears that FSU evidently reached out to and has now secured the services of former Clemson and Oregon State quarterback DJ Uiagalelei. But man, a week before the game, I mean, that is an absolute garbage move. They lost to Georgia 63-3. And Georgia coach Kirby Smart, I think, said it best in his post-game media press conference. He said, people need to look at what happened tonight, and they need to fix it. People need to look at what happened, and they need to fix this. Everybody is saying we had our guys. Florida State didn't have their guys. I could listen to all that, but college football has got to decide what they want. I know things are changing and how things are going to change next year. But you know what? There's still going to be bowl games outside of the playoffs. People need to decide what they want and what they want to get out of it. It's really unfortunate for those kids on the other sideline that had to play in that game that didn't have their full arsenal. Affected the game 100%. So, yeah, they played without Jordan Travis out for the season. Wide receivers Keon Coleman and Johnny Wilson, who just elected to opt out, because of following the college football playoff snub. They had 53 scholarship players dressed for the Orange Bowl last Saturday, several of whom had never played a snap. Georgia had most of their regulars suited up. Georgia racked up 673 yards of offense to Florida State's 209. They had 36 first down to Florida State's 11, rushed for 372 yards to Florida State's 63. This article closes with this. Neither team reached their goal of winning a national championship in 2023, but collectively made a statement at Saturday's Orange Bowl that the current bowl system is broken. Ain't that the truth? Look, college football playoff championship game is set to go on this coming Monday. The two participants are number 1, Michigan from the Big Ten, and number 2, Washington, also about to be in the Big Ten. They're playing their last game as a Pac-12 team. Now, Michigan tied Bama late in regulation, and they stopped them on fourth down from the 3-yard line to win 27-20 in overtime. Washington held on to beat Texas. They knocked away a pass in the end zone on the game's final play. They won 37-31. And again, just as I refuse to watch either of those two games, I will not watch Monday either. Why not? Well, like I said before, the FSU stuff, and I believe Kirby Smart's comments, you're watching one team which has been caught at least a form of cheating on two different occasions. By the way, one of those contains multiple occurrences with one of those forms, i.e. the Michigan sign stealing. And the other team, due to COVID relaxation rules and the open movement of players, has a quarterback who graduated from high school a year before my youngest nephew. Yeah, he graduated from high school a year before my youngest nephew, who's graduated and has a job. No, he's my nephew's not Connor McCaffrey old. But he's in his sixth year, and I think this 6-7 or more year thing is going to hurt college sports almost as much as NIL and the portal itself. Look, I respect Michael Penix Jr., but his actual junior year came back in the 2020 season. He's on his third senior year. I mean, what the hell? Let's see. The transfer portal closed yesterday in terms of being able to enter it. At this point, according to the latest numbers, over 27 players have entered. Almost 1,900 have committed elsewhere. A robust 50 have withdrawn their names. What I was reading, it wasn't exactly clear what exact period it covers, but still, I mean, you get the gist. So what's going to happen with them? I mean, I've said it before. Something's got to give for the bowl games. I get with an expanded playoff that the bowls will become less important than they already are. But it's still a reward for a decent season. Now, again, Minnesota this year went 5-7, got a bowl. But that, to me, hits of too many bowl games. Not, you know, Big Ten, by the way, went 5-4 in bowls thus far. Well, actually went 5-4 bowls. The College Football Playoff champion is not a bowl game, technically. Northwestern, Minnesota, Rutgers, Maryland, and, of course, Michigan all won. The losers were Ohio State, Penn State, Wisconsin, and Iowa. I think they're going to have to, you know, bowl games, the whole thing, they're going to have to do some tie-ins with NIL. They're going to have to do something to make sure these kids – look, I get it. People say, it's their body and all that stuff. You know what? You still got the chance – to showcase yourself for the pros. Abandoning your teammates like that, I'm sorry, it's just wrong. With regard to the Iowa Hawkeyes, there were no further entries to the portal. There is no news on any commitments from the portal, which will be tough anyway, given the scholarship numbers available, or rather not available. Linebacker Jay Higgins and tight end Luke Lachey now both have announced they will stay for the 2024 season. Still no word from others, although I will look for it. Torrey Taylor, the punter, set a new record for total punting yardage, and it stood since 1938. Jay Higgins tied the Iowa record for most tackles in a season. Defensive end Joe Evans went out with a bang as well. 5 tackles, 4 of them sacks. Definitely going to be missed next year. So now to the Citrus Bowl, in which the Hawkeyes looked like they literally took the 4-week period between the Big Ten Championship game and Monday's Citrus Bowl. I think they spent it playing video games. I mean, one, we didn't look well prepared, but as Brother Tommy said during our group text, 4 weeks to prepare to do exactly the same thing we've been doing all season. Hawkeye Mike just told me Jabari Harris, cornerback, just announced he is returning next year. Good news indeed. Like I said, we didn't look well prepared. We were actually moving the ball on our second drive of the game, and then there was a hill we couldn't climb. Or more precisely, a hellacious play that I think obliterated all momentum when quarterback Deacon Hill threw into double coverage in the end zone on 3rd and goal. Yeah, he followed that brilliant play up. He got sacked multiple times. He followed that up, though, in the third quarter with a fumble at our own 2-yard line. Then he iced the cake with a pick 6 to start the 4th quarter. I mean, it's just It wasn't good. That brought in backup, though, quarterback Marco Linez. While his passing definitely was no big bargain. Frankly, how could it be? I mean, you're down 28-0 against a team that is now playing to just defend the pass. I mean, plus we were going with empty backfields on almost every play that he was in. I mean, I didn't expect him, you know. But his mobility was a breath of fresh air for me and probably assume other Hawkeye fans. We haven't seen that from a quarterback quite a while. He extended plays. He extended drives with his legs. He didn't turn the ball over, i.e. no fumbles or interception. Again, though, to my mind, his accuracy is eerily similar to the person that's been playing ahead of him. Just my opinion, folks. So I'm going to grade the units. Offense, the line, I'm going to give a solid D+ or C-. Run blocking was spotty, although I got to say the sacks given up were rarely on the offensive line, mostly on the quarterback and the receivers. Still, the line needs to be better. They need to be consistent. And frankly, I have a sinking feeling that the drop-off is a result of Brian Ferentz leaving as O-line coach. Marco Linez should have been given a chance 6 games ago. I would agree. But I do think in the case of the line, the drop-off is due to Brian Ferentz leaving the post of offensive line coach. I hope I'm wrong. But wide receivers, I'm going to give them a solid D. Like, they did make a couple plays, a catch here and end around there. But my God, I was watching. These guys just can't seem to get open. And holy crap, the drops. I'll tell you, Nico Reganey had a drop, at least one. Caleb Brown had 2 critical drops. And folks, these guys are getting paid now, so I don't have a problem naming names. Now maybe, you know, I don't know. It's some of it's on the line. Some of it's on the line. A lot of it's on the line. But guys, you got to get open. Tight ends, I'm going to give them a solid C+. They did not do the job bailing out the QB like they have in previous seasons on occasion, but for the most part, no. But, you know, frankly, with the top two of them being out over half the year, a third one also missed time, we couldn't expect anything like, you know, a Noah Fant, T.J. Hockenson, Sam Laporta, et cetera. They did block well. I did watch that while I was at the game. When they weren't contested, they made the catches, 1 or 2. But here it was, you know, we back in the middle of the season, Iowa fans were clamoring for throws to the wide receivers. Well, you know, the first game or two, people could say, oh, they were surprised to be getting the ball. But, you know, by the 14th game of the season, you need to be making that catch. Running backs, I'm going to give them an incomplete. There were some decent runs. I saw a missed blitz pickup. But basically, running into stacked boxes as often as they do, it's hard to expect big rushing numbers. Now, they averaged just over 3.5 yards of carry. 2 or 3 of our 4 top longest runs were by our quarterbacks. Yeah, believe it or not, Deacon Hill had a 10-yarder. Marco Linez had a couple, had a 16-yarder on a 4th and 15. That was really, really nice. He got spun around and held onto the ball. Which brings me to the quarterbacks. F and C+, B-. Sorry, Deacon Hill should have been pulled after the interception in the end zone on our 2nd drive. I'm not saying pull him for the game. I'm saying he should have been, what are you seeing? Adjust. I'm not saying he couldn't return after getting an early pull. Frankly, with Marco Linez's mobility, it could have loosened up the Tennessee defense, could have opened lanes for the running backs, could have forced Tennessee defensive backs to respect the run on almost every down and not just be able to sell out for the pass on 3rd and long. Deacon Hill gets an F, solely on the merits, or lack thereof, of a score-killing interception a fumble on his own 2-yard line, and a pick six that looked like he was throwing it right at the defender. I swear to God. The fumble on the 2-yard line came while the game was, theoretically anyway, still within reach. It was 14-0 at that point. Game was in reach. Marco gets the C+. I probably should give him a B-. I mean, I'm sorry. His accuracy wasn't there. Now, partly understandable, his first action. But again, his legs bailed us out more than once. Tennessee was literally selling out to defend the pass at that point. Probably should go with a B+ almost. Here's the sad part. This is the sad part in quarterback play. When Tennessee downed a punt on our 4-yard line, I felt a sense of doom right then and there. Literally, it was just like, oh, I just don't. Because I knew the first play, it was going to a running back. Let's do that same dive play that gets us out of our own shadow of our end zone. Got to come up with something better than that, Brian. Defense, I'll give the line a solid B-. They were playing without Ethan Herquette. Tennessee did gash us on the run a bit. True freshman quarterback for Tennessee, Nico Iabaleva, did some great scrambles, I got to say. But we did get some pressure. We didn't get dominated too badly, but he just avoided a lot of it. Linebacker, A- to A. Jay Higgins and Nick Jackson were absolute machines all over the field, playing both run sets, pass coverage. There were a few plays, and this is across the board, where better angle pursuit angles might have helped. But I would also say this. They did not have any real film on Nico Iabaleva or Iabaleva or whatever. He got the start after their season-long starter Joel Milton opted out. So Tennessee also did something. They used some unorthodox splits along the line, which I think probably confused some gap assignments, and they mixed them up. I mean, there was a time when it looked like, from what I was sitting and everything, it looked like a couple times they were splitting one side, like the guard was split a little deeper on, or a little more on one side, but not on both. Or the guard and tackle splits were different sometimes. I didn't quite understand it, but I only noticed it because it looked at one point like they were almost attacking those gaps. It was weird. I didn't get it. I think when you leave that gap, you're trying to move away, or at least perception of that away. But no, the linebackers get an A- or an A. Very solid. Defensive backs. I'm going to give them a B+. At times an A-. They did not give up the big play. But again, they played off their receivers a lot, which I get is sort of business as usual for a Phil Parker defense. They were great in run support. Again, weird pursuit angles. But overall, I think they really did a really good job. We did not give up big pass plays. We did not give up passing touchdowns, I don't believe. Special teams, coverages were good. No big returns were given up. We had some decent returns ourselves, but also some questionable choices on our punt returns. There was a time we should have tried to let the ball bounce in. Torrey Taylor, of course, his usual stellar self, punted for an average of 51.4 yards, put 2 inside the 20. Tennessee actually had negative 5 yards on punt returns, so that was a plus. Drew Stevens, he only kicked off once. That was the start of the second half. It was a touchback. So overall, I guess I'd give it a B+. We had one good kick return where we got flagged for an illegal block in the back. And then another one, it wasn't really special teams' fault, but Caden Weechen returned a kickoff to the 35, and we probably get a delay of game penalty. How does that happen? How in hell does that happen? Bringing in T. Bodie, I see that hand pop up. T. Bodie, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Hank. Man,
how's it going?
First off, it's going good. It's going good. I just got you. You're spot on all your grades. and as usual. But, you know, what's worse than seeing an 18 or 19-year-old driving around campus in a Bentley with his gold chains? You know, NIL money is going to change the game dramatically. Tennessee was a much better team. Their quarterback, I saw, is getting $8 million in NIL money. He's a freshman,
yeah.
Hadn't played it down.
You
exactly. know, what's going to happen when USC and UCLA donors start really coughing it up and realizing, you know, they can buy teams and buy wins and national championships? It's just gross.
Yeah, it is. But you know what? We've known it was coming. It's been here now. I just don't see – I think there are some – it's not just NIL. It's NIL plus portal plus the ability to opt out that I think is just going to kill the average fan, you know, the person that watches four games a year. You know, the person in Orlando that watches four UCF games a year on television is going to – that's who they're going to lose. You know, they're not going to lose the person that's there
yep.
every week at tailgates. They're going to lose the casual or the semi-interested fan. And
just like the NFL attendance, you know, the viewership's going down for whatever reason.
Yeah.
College viewership is going to go way down, I think. And I think that it's getting exploited. I think, thank God for Kirby Smart and
yeah.
saying what he did. Because, you know, I can't blame a single one of those FSU guys for sitting there saying, you know, up your...
Yeah,
I
cannot believe the number of people that are saying that FSU obviously didn't belong there. And it's like, really? What don't people get?
Yeah.
You know, it's, Al from him and Vito's show, he asked me, he said, I've been following this, and I got to wonder, what's your feeling on this about you? You know, I'm pissed at FSU. And I said, don't blame FSU. Blame the committee.
Yeah.
They basically told FSU's players that their first 11 or 12 games didn't even count.
Oh.
And
yep.
that winning with a third-string quarterback, by the way, which Ohio State did in 2014, that winning with a third-string quarterback isn't good enough. And I mean, sorry, that is so wrong. I mean, I don't know. And you know, you can make the argument. The 3-4 team, meaning Alabama and Texas, or Texas and Alabama, maybe you can make the argument they didn't belong there. Well, they both lost. It's not like a 3 or a 4 seed won in this thing, but the top 2 seeds won. So you can make the argument that, they didn't belong there. FSU could have given them a better game. You know, I mean, that argument is there. Now, look, some of the teams, Penn State, Ohio State from the Big Ten, did not look good in their bowl games either. But again, opt-outs, transfer portal, something's got to give.
They weren't undefeated either. You know,
no. But
think that NIL money needs to probably have a salary cap and be administered by the schools or somehow. And then the players, you don't get your payments or whatever if you opt out or don't play in the – especially next year with a 12-team playoff.
Yeah.
But somehow they're going to have to tie that in. They're not going to be able to change it or take it away because that door is already open.
I don't think you're going to see – I mean – by the way, how many players opted out of the playoff? I don't think any, you know.
I think there was a couple.
Of the four CFP teams? I doubt it. I could look, but I think it's guys.
Yeah.
I don't think any of their starters opted out, you know. But, I mean, look at Penn State. Their starting quarterback hit the transfer portal. Ryan Day made a very stupid comment afterwards that everything's on the table. You know, you don't make that statement publicly, I don't think. But that's just me, you know. Look, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, Brian Ferentz, the week leading up to the game, he said he expected that they expected Deacon Hill was going to go the distance, and they didn't have any plays or packages for Marco Linez. Why commit to that? Why commit to that?
You think you're out of a job, why not change something just a little bit?
Why even say it or commit to it? That's what I. Why doesn't he just say,
right.
"Well, we'll watch how the game develops and we'll go from there"? And maybe that's been his problem. Maybe that's been Brian Ferentz's problem. And that's what Brother Tommy to me said on a call one time. You know, we often start well, because we have our script for our first two series or whatever it is. But it's like after that, Brian Ferentz seemed like he never got into any kind of a flow beyond the scripted plays. I mean, he did at times, but, you know, I mean, he's gone now, so it doesn't really matter, but, you
Thank
know.
God.
Yeah, exactly. I hate to say it. I feel bad for him on the one hand, because I don't think he wanted to do well. I can't believe he didn't want to do well. And it's just, you know, I mean, the drops, there's so many things beyond play call. The drops by the wide receivers got to get fixed. I mean,
yeah.
You can say it's Deacon Hill throwing. You can say it's still Deacon Hill throwing bullets. But man, this has been going on for how many games now? You know, eight or nine games.
Maybe he's just not throwing catchable balls. In other words, the spin on the ball doesn't seem like it's a snap pass or anything.
I don't buy that. Considering how many games they've had to get this going, you know. I mean, and frankly, And Marco had balls that were dropped too. Now his, you know, he wasn't making the greatest throws either. But it boils down to this: our passing game has got to become effective, or the running game will continue to suffer, you know, incrementally more each year.
Well, I know you didn't watch those two playoff games, but they were how football should be played.
Sure.
You know, it came back. There was offense. There was defense. There was special teams, and they both had their moments. And momentum swings play the game just like any other game came into play. But those were fun games to watch.
I don't doubt it. I don't, you know, although, you know, I'm a little, I think the whole extending after COVID and the open portal, I mean, Michael Penix is literally in his sixth year.
So I totally agree with your rationale for not watching them.
Yeah, no, but I mean, Michael Penix is in his sixth year. Jim Harbaugh has been suspended twice this year for basically breaking recruiting rules. You know, or not one. One was the sign stealing. By the way, did you notice that Connor Stallions, the guy that left, you know, the sign stealing guy, that he was actually at the Rose Bowl? I mean, I don't think he was on the sideline or anything, but I mean, good Lord, I mean. You know, and the other thing, everyone's talking about the portal right now. You know, we need this, we need that. And look, if there's an actual need and there's something there, sure, I get it. But right now, the Hawks, I have one scholarship to play with if everybody comes back. They have one scholarship to play with. And frankly, they need to fix what they have. I mean, look, if it means current starters getting passed over, so be it. I mean, it's not the first time it would have happened. But you were talking about the $8 million man. You know what? He's guaranteed a roster spot, or maybe not a starting spot, but he's guaranteed a roster spot with $8 million in NIL money.
Yep. So, what about that quarterback down in Texas, Arch Manning? You know, did you see that photo of the press conference? The regular starting quarterback has a microphone and not one reporter around him, and he's looking over his shoulder, and Arch Manning went, 20 reporters standing around them.
Yep. I mean, that's...
That was telling. It was very telling.
Yeah, very telling.
He's got to make a decision to come back or face that every game.
Yeah, and Quinn Ewers. Well, don't forget, he was at Ohio State at one point, so...
Yeah. And he did a great job, I mean, you know.
Yeah, here's in a nutshell how I saw this season. Bear with me a second, okay? So remember Stripes... the movie Stripes with John Candy as Ox.
Sure.
And remember, they're doing the obstacle course, and Ox is like careening downhill. He's totally out of control. So remember we talked about our jet sweeps or our end-arounds, whatever you want to call them?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So I'm walking out of the game before it's over. I was getting ready to leave, and then I saw Linez warming up on the sideline, and I thought, I'm staying for now.
Right.
My wife was not happy, as you can imagine. But so... the one series ends, so we're walking out, and I'm walking past an end zone view, and I see a jet sweep slash underarm whatever to Caleb Brown on the last drive. Now he's fast, obviously, but he's literally looking like he's out of control. There was room. If he had cut up field earlier, he would have had room. He probably would have gotten a first down.
Yeah.
But he was like out of control.
Hardcore to the sideline.
It's like he was totally out of control and couldn't even make the cut. You know, because so he ran basically into the contained guys. It was unbelievable. I literally looked at that, watching that, and thinking to myself, my God, it is Ox running down the obstacle course downhill. I mean, it was just the whole season. We were at times moving like crazy, but with no control.
But Tennessee's last touchdown that they actually scored, that was a jet sweep that the guy cut and cut right against the grain and stepped right in, untouched, basically.
Yeah.
And the coverage was there.
I mean, literally, we have got to the passing game's got to be better. There's a lot more that's got to be better than Brian Ferentz, so to speak. I think the line problem is a result of Brian Ferentz leaving that position. You know,
Could be. I mean, Doyle's not there anymore and things like that.
People bring that up, but you know what? It hasn't affected the defensive line for the most part. You know, it hasn't affected other positions. I mean, I just think the line has got to, you know, and you look at the recruits though. Look, you know, we're bringing in bigger, heavier guys. Brian and Doyle and whoever. We're bringing in guys that were several were converted tight ends, or they were bringing guys in who and honing them. I don't know. I just can't figure it out. But I think that's part of it. You know, I just think they have got to. Well, I don't know. Hopefully, a new offensive coordinator is going to change that. I'm not sure. You know, Hawkeye Mike messaged about Cade McNamara being back. I'm not all that sold on.
He wasn't very impressive at Penn State games, and he was healthy then. So.
Yeah. Well, theoretically, he'd had that injury in camp, and so I think he was never really.
I think
Marco and Deacon both, and any other. I think you tell him, you know, like anything else, this is a true open competition. I think you have to go into spring ball, and my guess is Cade won't even be suited up for spring ball.
Well, a lot's going to change in the next week or two, you know, next month anyhow, when he names an OC. You know, it wouldn't surprise me to see him just have a press conference and say, hey, folks, thanks, but I'm going to leave this to better hands. And then you got to, you know, they haven't locked in our AD yet. And I don't know.
I know people say that they think he's gone. I don't believe that. I just don't.
I don't think he leaves the program that way either. But, you know, he's tarnished his own legacy with his son hanging on to him.
I mean, it's funny. This year, more than 2021 or 2022, this year I actually would have, you know, if they had not made the announcement when they did, had they gotten to the end of the season and he said, look, the best we can give is an incomplete this year. We lost two tight ends. We lost our starting quarterback. We lost, you know, I probably would have given it half a pass, but knowing that we never gave Joey Labus, who maybe not have earned it, but never gave Marco Linares or Joey Labus a shot at all. You know, I don't get the idea that you have to play one quarterback the whole time. I mean, you know, the old mantra, if you play two quarterbacks, it means you don't have one or whatever it is. It means you have no quarterback. It doesn't have to be that. Look what Purdue did one year against us. I mean, you can design packages around it. I think you just have to
to do just what you said, though. Set your quarterback down for a series. Tell him to settle down. Look at it. Think about what he's doing, you know, and get him settled down.
Yeah.
You can back in the rest of the game if he can correct himself, but if he can't, then you replace him.
I mean, you do that with running backs anyway. I don't understand. Now, Drew Stevens' dad did that one stupid tweet where, funny that only, you know, other positions aren't subject to having their guys pulled. I mean, he might have a point, you know, especially seeing what we saw, but, you know, that's not the right – the right answer is – you know, hey, good on the kid that came in and made the, you know, the replacement kicker that came in and made the field goal. Good on him.
Yep.
You know.
Yep.
So I just don't, you know, you got several guys coming back now. I mean, Jabari Harris just announced, Lachey last week, Higgins last week. You know, Eric All's kind of the wild card, but Kate has said he's staying. You know, really, we're waiting on two. I mean, as much as we'd love the others, we're really waiting on Cooper DeGene and Sebastian Castro. If those two stay, yeah, then hell. You know, that's what we're really looking for. And frankly, you know, I could go both ways. So I would tell a kid as a coach, selfishly, I would love to have you back, but son, you're ready now. You are ready now, and so you have nothing left to prove. But if you stay,
God,
we're
he looks
absolutely
so young, though.
Who, Cooper DeGene?
Yeah.
Yeah, he does. He looks like he's 12 years old. I mean,
they say he's first round. Man, you got to go. DBs don't go in the top 15 picks.
Yeah,
you know, how much
exactly
better to prove his stock? You know, if that, in fact, you know, being a pro football player is his lifelong dream, which I think when you're good and get the accolades, it becomes that.
Sure.
You know, maybe he wants to get a degree and things, but that would be foolish. Get it later, you know, after you play out your years
in
the NFL.
And frankly, players are getting degrees in 3 years now anyway because they're there all year. They're doing stuff online to compensate and to add to it. So I just, you know, the boy in the chat room says, but you need two quarterbacks if you could switch them. How many quarterbacks are there? He says, are worth to have two good ones? Absolutely, it's worth it. The problem, boy, and you would agree with this, T, the ability to keep two quarterbacks. I mean, it's hard enough, as Ohio State is finding out, to keep your starter around. Now, some of the guys that left, that Cam Ward from Washington State, that DJ Uiagalelei guy, I mean, those two guys were coming from programs that are the two remaining teams of the Pac-12. So there, I get that, and the coach of one of them left. But, I mean, you know, how easy would it be to keep two great quarterbacks in your team? Not easy at all. You know, I just don't see it. So, you know, you're talking about how young DeGene looks. He is the B.J. Armstrong of Iowa football. Remember B.J. Armstrong in basketball? Always looked like he was about 12 years old. You know, and so seeing DeGene, he literally looks like that. He looks like a kid, so. But yeah, if you're first round, I mean, Desmond King was regarded as probably second round. He stayed his senior year. His stock dropped. Now he's still making money on Sundays, but his stock dropped after staying for his senior year. So, you know, there's no guarantee.
There was I can't remember who it was about, but the father told him, you know, if I had to play over again, I'd stay that last year. You're always going to make more money, and money's not everything. Come back and see what you can do with your teammates.
Yeah, and that's what I think.
You know, can you improve on a 10-win season? So, you know.
Yeah, and in the end, you know what? I've got to say this, and I'm not the first person to say it, but I totally agree with it. When you think about what we lost and how our offense looked, to win 10 games this year, I don't care who it was against. I mean, I'm tired of people saying, "Who's casual? We play a good team." You know, I don't care. We won 10 games. That's not a bad season at, by Iowa standards at any time. You know, it's not something
Make
that we saw every
year. Better.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm in a sour mood if we lose. So
I am too. And it ruins my weekend usually. And it did it in college, and it does it now. You know, it ruins my weekend when we have a loss. So, but yeah, there's other stuff. I think. We're going to just have to – I mean, things have got to change. I mean, it just – and I'm not saying get rid of the quarter or the coach. I'm really not. I'm not saying, you know, dump all the
starters. No, we're getting rid of my – I think just moving Brian Ferentz will help everybody's attitude. I don't know. I don't know what he was like in the locker room, but
You know,
somehow
I've seen,
I think,
I've
you
seen,
know, that lawsuit and everything.
But, you know, I've seen a lot of tweets from people, former players, et cetera, that spoke nothing but highly of him. And I think the way you saw he and his players after the Illinois game when they clinched the Big Ten West title, you know, I think that was pretty indicative that he's not as unpopular as people want to make him out to be, you know. You know, on the other hand, he was still polarizing. You know, it doesn't matter. You can love a guy to death, but it doesn't mean he's not polarizing. You know, President
Hey, I
Trump,
love reading his interviews.
Yeah.
His interviews made a lot. You know, he's a genuine good guy. He's Kirk's son. You know,
yeah,
he's got
absolutely
a conscience. He's trying to do his best, but his best just isn't.
Yeah,
it's like Deacon Hill. He's not D1 material.
Yeah, and that's why I say the same thing about Deacon Hill. Don't blame him. You know, you can blame the coach, or you can blame whoever. I mean, blame Cade's injury. It doesn't matter. Now, you could also say, though, that's where it gets back to the coach. The coaches should I don't understand why there weren't at least packages given for – now, look, I mean, it's not like we were winning blowouts after Cade went down. I don't think we had a single double-digit – oh, maybe Rutgers and Wisconsin technically, but I mean – or close to. But, I mean, really, we just we didn't have that much room for it. But, you know, what if it had been an injury to Deacon in Game 9? You know, you would have had to do it by necessity anyway. So I think you've just got to let guys get some action at some point. It's just as simple as that. It's got to happen, and it's not until they get out of the mindset that you've got to have one quarterback you go the whole way with. I think it's gonna continue to hurt every year because you're gonna lose guys. I mean, and I'm not talking about
injuries
Joey Labus.
That are gonna happen.
Yeah, and I'm not talking about Joey Labus. It sounds like there were other issues there, but
well,
you know, it boils down to this. I mean, it's hard enough to keep your starting quarterback anymore. You've got to figure out how to keep enough quarterbacks to have depth and stuff. I mean, we're going to face it at running back. You know, we've got a lot of guys at running back that want carries, deserve carries, frankly. It's going to be hard to keep them all. Now, supposedly both Caleb Johnson and Caleb Brown said at one of the media events during this past week that, you know, they're Hawkeyes through and through. They don't have any intention of leaving, you know, so you got to get.
You know, they recruit solid kids at Iowa, obviously. And,
yeah,
you know, so the character in those kids has got that team mentality. And so it's not like they're at Michigan and can just jump up and leave. They like their teammates and they like their head coach. You can tell that.
Yeah.
Oh, they like
exactly
bought into the philosophy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you remember when I had Felicia Goodson on, she said at the time, you know, Kirk Ferentz isn't a right. You know, all that stuff gets taken out of context, blown out of proportion, whatever you want to say. And I think it's true. I think the players like each other. You know, and I think that's another, you know, I heard George O'Leary speak one time when he was coach at UCF, and he said, that's not the players or the parents I got to convince. It's the girlfriend. Well,
yeah,
that's cool. That's a cool sentiment and all, but I get the feeling, and it's just a feeling, and I'm sure it's not unique to him, but I'm pretty sure that Kirk Ferentz and the staff at large, they're not just recruiting the players. They're looking at the parents, you know? You walk in, I would not be surprised if they knew well in advance of when it happened, that, as an example, that Caden Proctor was going to decommit. It would not shock me to know that, because I think everything you saw from his parents on Twitter, everything you saw in any interview with these people they're not all in on Iowa. They're all in on them, you know. They moved to Alabama and all that kind of stuff. I mean,
yeah.
You know, and I think, you know what? You remember when I had Justin Britt's parents on, and Justin, I was surprised that his father said he didn't like the NIL idea. And I was shocked, because I figured every parent, he says, no, because it's going to create a lot of it's going to create a lot of I instead of the E-M in E-A-M in team or whatever. You know, there's no I in team, but there's an M-E. Well, I think, yeah, it created a lot of I's in a lot of places. And so,
yep, I agree.
You know, now the other problem is we only got one, assuming everyone stays, we only have one scholarship to play with in terms of the portal. So what's the point, you know? I don't know that there is. I think we have to look inside and see what can we do with what we have, and are we happy? You know, I say, don't go after anything in the portal. That's a stupid statement. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying, given the nature of what you have scholarship wise, it would not be smart to just go around looking, because what are you telling your current players? You know, you're telling them really that, well, I'm not confident. And that's, you know, that sends a wrong message. So just got to, you know, it's going to be tough. I mean, Big 12, you know, the Big,
keep
the Big
developing
10.
The players.
Yeah, the Big 10 goes to 18 teams next year. You know, I think the you know, if the two teams that make the championship game are probably are, you know, shoe-ins for playoff consideration, but the third team down, probably not. So, you know, are people going to start? Again, it's going to get back to what bowls are going to survive, what's going to happen. So, you know, NIL's ruined it. And, you know, there was an interesting point raised about that, you know, making NIL, making bowl game participation a condition of it. In this day and age, how many of those kids are going to say they went to the doctor and the doctor says he's not cleared to play? You know, the fact that you even have to think, the fact that that even comes up tells you, a whole symptom, a huge symptom. So anyway, so your Christmas and New Year were good?
We're all good out here. We had a brother come in from Colorado, and we had a big happy family.
There's no snow
in Iowa yet, so everything's good. Although I was in Iowa City the other day, they got 4 inches last week. So.
Oh, really? Okay. So, yeah, and I guess there's more coming. So,
yeah,
that's going to be. So anyway, speaking of Colorado, before we leave the air, I have a last internet laughy from the Babylon Bee. This one's good. Colorado bans Trump from ballot over concerns that the usual election rigging system might fail. It's so perfect.
There was another good headline in the Babylon Bee about your stuff with Harvard, with the President Gay from Harvard. I can't remember what it was, but it's
there were several.
It up.
There was one about her that they said something like, she responds to criticism with criticism of plagiarism with "I have a dream" speech.
Yeah, that was it. That was awesome.
Yeah, that was classic stuff.
That's
it
golden.
Definitely.
The whole you know, stuff going on with the football season and everything winding down brings in the other sports. You know, I like hockey, so I'm starting to watch that a little bit more. But did you, and I think I put something in our chat about the wrestling and the Ferrari brothers.
Oh, yeah.
Did you read that article?
Yes.
About that? Oh, my God. What drama is going on at the wrestling program at the University of Iowa? We could be good. We could beat Penn State if those guys came on board, but there's so much baggage with them.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know how you the football team's had their moments with that kind of stuff too, but, you know, Kirk pretty much nips that in the bud, says no more of this, so.
Yeah, and Brands just likes it and encourages it. He didn't address it individually. You know, I think he does, but he does it more out of the media, and I don't know. I watched that 3 times.
I think that whole triumvirate, that whole trio is bad news. I think that's, if it were my choice, I would be running the other way.
Well, the one kid's already on, you know, there wrestling as part of the program.
Right.
He signed up. The other one was wrestling but hadn't signed yet. And this AJ was national champion. He's one of the best wrestlers out there at any weight as a freshman. And to flip off the university, to flip off all the Iowa fans, everyone just booed the heck out. That's something else. If no one's seen it, they got to go look that up.
Well, here's the other thing. You know, we're talking back to NIL real quick. Here's my other issue with NIL. It's supposed to be name, image, and likeness. Now, I know that Swarm ties it to some community service type stuff, you know, because ostensibly it's not to be for football. You're not getting this NIL money because just to play football. You're getting it for using your name, image, and likeness in certain ways. And the Swarm, I think, to their credit, is using it in a community service way. And I think pretty much every player is all in on the children's hospital type stuff. But, you know, other schools, it's not even that. There's no name, image, and likeness about it. You know, I would love to see some of these NIL deals and see how many of them require nothing or, you know, stuff that you know isn't done. You know,
absolutely.
The no-show job, basically. So
that's what it's going to become if it's not.
Yep, it will. Absolutely will. And that's where the problem is going to be down the road, is that, one, you're going to have kids that aren't necessarily going to do as well that are getting it. You know, again, it gets back to what happens to the kid that gets a good NIL deal and doesn't perform. You know, our collective going to hold that back? Because it's one thing for a school, you know, who has to honor a scholarship for the year for a kid that stays, you know, whether he's good, plays, doesn't play, whatever. They at least honor that. But how soon is a – I'm not saying the swarm, but, I mean, I'm sorry, and I hate to single out Alabama, but, you know, historically they've been this kind of shady pay-for-play all along. The Alabama collective, do you really see them continuing to pay 4 years for a kid that doesn't pan out? No. Should they? I don't know. You know, that's the other question. Should they? I don't know. I can't say yes or no. But at that point, if you know, when does school come into it? You know, why not also have NIL tied to some academic performance in some way? You know, how come we're not hearing anything about a kid that, you know, is, you know, doing NIL stuff for like tutors, become a tutor, you know? Or
well, to use a word that Hawkeye Mike would use, the NCAA is feckless going forward with this whole thing. And until somebody steps up and takes that bull, and maybe it's the coaches, Ferenc spoke out about, you know, just a little bit about the portal and stuff. You know, it's a combination of the things, and they're going to have to put it together a little better. And I'm sure they'll wait until after next year and see how the playoff system goes. But, you know, these players that can opt out at the end of Thanksgiving into the portal and be gone, I don't know.
Yeah,
I just don't know why it didn't work with offensive coordinators. Season over, it was over. Enter the portal there, Junior.
I don't know.
Maybe we would have scored a point. Did you see that stat? And I'll let you go after – the chart about teams that have lost three, that got shut out three times in 1 year?
No.
The top 10, I think the highest team had three wins out of the top 10 of schools that had
got shut out
three times.
Three
shut out. Yep. Iowa jumps in there with 10 wins at number one.
I know, 10 wins and get shut out three times. Well, remember, here's the opposite side of that. Remember I think it was the 75 Cincinnati Reds. They won 108 games, which at the time was, you know, almost unheard of. And they never got shut out that. They never got shut out that season.
No, I mean, really?
Yeah, they literally never got shut out that season. I mean, that's an amazing stat. And it might have been the 73. I remember, but I mean, literally, you know, they never got shut out. I mean, can you imagine?
Wow.
That, you know, literally 162 games.
Every game.
Yeah.
That's a humongous stat.
Yeah.
Anyhow, thanks for your commentary, Hank.
Oh, not at all. Thanks for calling in, and stay safe, and good luck if you get more snow and if it gets really cold. So.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Come down.
And
time.
Absolutely do. Stay in touch, man. We'll
Ciao.
Talk to you later. Ciao.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
And that is T. Bodie, one of my former college roommates, roomed one summer. And as I've said before, he actually played college football for a couple of years at a Division I AA school. So he knows of what he speaks, and he knows the team dynamics, et cetera. So, yeah. In closing, that's I guess the big thing this season is that it's becoming less and less like the college game and less of kids who play for the love of the game. And it's become more and more, I mean, almost worse than the NFL become that about money. Really has. It's, you know, hearing about coaches that are calling players in season, which is, has always been a no-no, but now they're not even disguise it. It's not a good thing, and something's got to be done, most definitely. Okay, folks, that's it for this week. We will be back next week, and it will be, we'll start hitting on more of what's happening with our lovely government types. They are, you know, things aren't going to get any better, but at least they're on, you know, the good thing is when they're on recess, things can't go that bad. Hate to say it, but things go a little bit better when they don't have activity going on in Washington, D.C. And, of course, Joe Biden's been on vacation since who knows what. He's on vacation again. So in the meantime, folks, have a great rest of your week. Have a great weekend. Be safe out there, most definitely. Let's hold people accountable this year. Maybe that should be our New Year's resolution. Maybe that should be our watchword for this year is accountability. Let's hope. In the meantime, folks, be safe. If you're in weather pattern, if you're getting snow or whatever, drive safe. And, hell, if it comes down to it, go skiing. I'm going paddling. So we'll be back next week, 6 o'clock. Don't forget Vito next Monday. Don't forget this Saturday, Minister Usama Dakduk, revealing the truth about Islam. Adios, folks. Have a good night.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.